Hello, everyone. Welcome to the California Association of Tactical Officers podcast, where we discuss a variety of SWAT-related topics. We believe tactics are a science, and the art is in how we apply those tactics. My name is Marcus Sprigg.
And I'm Brent Stratton.
And I would like to take a moment to thank Cato Gold sponsors for supporting the work that Cato does throughout California. I would like to thank Aardvark Tactical for their relentless support for Cato for many years. While they may be famous for their excellent customer service, Project 7 armor platform, and Sagine and low-key tactical robots, Aardvark works with teams to deliver custom integrated purpose-built solutions that are designed to protect tactical operators. They find, develop, and manufacture purpose-built products that enhance tactical operator safety. Check them out at aardvarktactical.com. Thank you to Battleboard, a company whose origins were founded by a Marine who was looking for a flexible, durable, and portable map tracking system to coordinate operations on the ground in Afghanistan. Several evolutions later, Battleboard has emerged as an industry leader for those coordinating small and large-scale operations in the field. Veteran-owned and made in America, start your next mission fully prepared with Battleboard. Check them out at battleboard.us. I'd like to thank a long-standing supporter of Cato and our chemical agent program. Founded in 1981, Combined Systems Incorporated is a recognized leader in the design, manufacture, and marketing of security products for the global defense and law enforcement markets. As the premier supplier of less lethal munitions and launching systems, CSI manufactures products for riot control, police tactical teams, corrections officers, and military units. CSI's blue chip customer base includes the U.S. Army, U.S. Marines, U.S. Navy, and the majority of U.S. law enforcement, as well as foreign military and security forces around the world. Check them out at combinedsystems.com. We are back on Chapter 7 of Sound Doctrine. This is Part 2. Chris Jenny joins me. Travis Norton, who was part of Part 1, is traveling. Just to remind folks where we left off in the previous Sound Doctrine Chapter 7 podcast, we left off at a tactical dilemma. And we talked a little bit about tactical dilemmas. They're used to force a decisive resolution with an adversary and occurs when a suspect is placed in such a predicament that no matter what is done, the predicament can be exploited. To achieve that dilemma, the commander attempts to place the suspect in such a position. Surrender is likely and resistance is futile. And they're either accomplished by the exploitation of space or time. And we're going to talk a little bit today about the rest of the chapter, about what those tactics are. But before we do, Chris would like to share a quote, as well as just highlight a couple of the things that we talked about in the previous chapter, because as always in Sound Doctrine, there's a lot of meat on the bones here.
Yeah, so after we did the last segment, one of the things that came to mind was Sun Tzu's quote, "Strategy without tactics is the slowest way to victory, and tactics without strategy is the noise before defeat." The quote is about aligning strategy, strategy being our ways, means, and end state with our tactics before we're involved in conflict. So this requires forecasting and asking the what-if questions before an incident actually occurs. One of the things that we constantly talk with new team leaders about is like looking at your mission sets. What are you expected to do? And what or how does your commander want to approach those problems? So making sure that what you're training aligns with those expectations. Getting back to that strategy without tactics, this should enable all of the teams that comprise the focus of effort to understand the commander's intent before the actual call out or incident so that they can train to function within those parameters set by their commander or that organization. Understanding those rules and expectations will enable decentralized decision making, and it falls in the spirit of off-strike tactic. For those that followed Helmuth von Moltke, that was the mission command leadership style that they were striving for. The other concept that we covered was maneuvering in time. And the important part to remember with this is that your timing is always relevant to your adversary. You only have to move faster than your adversary to force them to adjust to your actions or tactics, which forces them to continue to abandon and restart their OODA cycles. So if you're putting them into a tactical dilemma and you're maneuvering time, you're forcing their reaction to your actions, and hopefully all of your actions are in favor of the resolution that you're looking for.
Which is really a little bit about what we're talking about, right? Rather than just reacting to the suspect's action, we're going to respond, manipulate the situation, use terrain and time to our advantage to create an asymmetry to force that person into a tactical dilemma. So it all kind of works together. So after Sid finishes talking about the checkmate, so to speak, he talks about space and time, and then he goes right into some tactics. What are these maneuvers that we can use? And they're all commonly used in the military and in law enforcement. The first one he talks about is a pincer movement, a hammer and anvil. Works very similarly. So you're going to position your folks in a position of advantage so that even the threat of force becomes apparent. And he finds himself in this position, he has to surrender, right? So he goes on to kind of talk about other ways we deny space, which is physically or with chemical agents, stuff like that. Time, space, and deceptive diversion he goes into before he starts going into hammer and anvil. So let's talk about hammer and anvil.
Yeah. Hammer and anvil, military concept, adapted for law enforcement. Basically, you have a containment force. And for the sake of these examples that we're going to get on with tactics, we'll just talk about like a single structure. And we'll use the common 1, 2, 3, 4 side description. So we'll just assume that containment is on the 2, 3, and 4 sides, preventing any movement. You know, our adversary knows that trying to penetrate that containment force, they're not going to have success. And so the maneuver element is actually going to enter through the one side and continue to take ground away from the suspect until they surrender and they're able to take them into custody. And so that's your hammer and anvil. The maneuver team is your hammer. The containment team is the anvil. So you have restricted maneuver by setting that containment, and then maintain the ability to maneuver with your hammer element, and just incrementally taking terrain away from the suspect until the surrender is accomplished. Pretty simple to employ. It does require quite a bit of resources to set that strong perimeter. One of the ways that this is applied is trying to take away the suspect's will to fight, because it's a overwhelming force. And sometimes this is applied with our criminal barricades or on our standard kind of search warrant service. If you're applying a tactic to those law enforcement missions that we have.
And you can use terrain a lot of times as part of that, right? And so you think about crowd control, hammer and anvil, or you think about even just using a river or you know, something that the suspect kind of is a force multiplier where you don't have to put personnel there, but you can use something physical.
So right. So if talking about the crowd example, if you have containment on, you know, kind of the east and west side of you know, the crowd, and then to the north is a building, you know, a large commercial building, they can't get through or around it. The maneuver element is coming in from the south. That's another hammer and anvil using terrain.
We did hammer and anvil. The next one really should be the envelope.
Exactly.
So another time tested, used over more than 2,000 years. And it basically, again, attempts to apply strength against weakness. So you avoid the suspect's front which is usually more heavily fortified or guarded, or even just that's where he's looking or paying attention, and you try to strike from flanks.
So envelopment is one of the tactics that we stress with our team leaders in their mission planning, right? So you're still going to have to do the containment. You still have, you know, if you're comparing back to the hammer and anvil, you have that solid containment. The difference is your hammer, that maneuver element, is not pushing through to one side. You're not going strength on strength. You're looking to exploit a weakness. Could be a side door, backslider, a window, and you add a diversion or a movement that creates some type of deception at the likely point of entry. So again, using a residential structure as an example, your diversion would be on the one side while the maneuver element actually goes through a weaker or less fortified entry point. This is also used in warrant service and can be used in HRT. Generally, with the envelopment, it can be accomplished with less personnel, but does require more coordination and planning to do it correctly, because timing becomes a really important function at this point.
You have a lot of moving parts, so you're going to need a really good plan and you're going to need really good communication.
Yep.
Probably the next tactic is called the pincer movement, which is a little bit more complicated, I guess, requires a little bit more command and control, can have a lot more self-induced friction points, but can be very overwhelming. And so like the envelopment, it exploits a suspect's inability to guard in every direction. A pincer movement really is not a separate tactic, just a variation of the envelopment. It works by employing two components of force closing towards each other with the suspect caught between them. A suspect can't stay because one of the other forces will catch him, and can't run because he'll encounter the other one. Very commonly, I think we do this without thinking and without any coordination or command and control, and it just works out a lot of the times. But the problem with this is if you don't control it or understand it, you can create a variety of crossfire issues.
Yeah, so we can look at this like from a patrol standpoint. Your yard searches or a foot pursuit. You have a pursuing element, and then you have the second element that's trying to anticipate the suspect's course that they're taking, and they're going to maneuver to cut them off or continue to increase containment and, you know, tighten down. You may start with multiple blocks, get it narrowed down to a block, then get it narrowed down to a couple of yards, and then a single yard, and then maybe a shed in the back of the yard. But both teams, and it could be more than two, are moving simultaneously. In a SWAT perspective, or from the SWAT tactics, this could be simultaneous teams entering into a structure with the designated, you know, blue line where they can maintain fields of fire. But they're both simultaneously entering and maneuvering, looking for contact. So this usually is used in an HRT or something has a lot more at stake, where you don't have as much time as you would with the implementing a hammer and anvil. The big thing, like Mike has pointed out, is you have simultaneous elements maneuvering and looking to exploit weakness while closing in on the suspect.
And you're going to create greater disparity with that tactic, but you have a lot more self-induced friction, and it's a lot more fragile a plan because of all the things that can go wrong. And we all know how Murphy's Law works in favor of the adversary most of the time. So think about, a lot of you who listen are working, police officers, deputies, law enforcement, and you get this working real well, and then you just have one terrain feature that you can't go over, you got to go around, and now you've broken that chain, and now there's a gap. Right, where the bad guy or great gal, the adversary, can get through, where you miss them. So I think all four maneuvers are things we do. I don't know that we call them that. But again, if we're focusing on the why, it would probably behoove us to know the options, what's good and bad about each one of them, and be able to explain that these are founded in science and are thousands of years old. And so they're tried and true methods for us to execute our jobs in a really scientific way, right? So that's kind of how he closes the chapter. But before we kind of summarize his last few sentences, I do want to highlight some of the things that we went over in this chapter. But go ahead, Chris.
So one other tactic that we kind of touched on, it's not highlighted in Sound Doctrine. It's present in Field Command and sort of discussed in other places, is swarming. Swarming is the one that patrol and some street crimes units frequently use. It's very fast, but that's basically multiple semi-autonomous units converging on a suspect or a location. So examples where this could be applied, or if you're looking at a swarming tactic, it could be responding to an officer who needs help or an officer who's down, or it could be describing a tactic of active shooter response for those agencies that teach the solo officer response. Pincer can also be described or applied to active shooter response for those agencies that are sending in multiple simultaneous contact teams. But both of those, both pincer and swarming, are very rapid. The downside of the swarming is there's very little command and control. So these semi-autonomous units that are running around, sometimes they can be working against each other. The likelihood of friendly fire is even higher than it could be with the pincer maneuver, because there's not designated maneuver elements. And oftentimes swarming isn't conducive of effective communication. So you're making decisions based upon what you see and hear directly in front of you, and those aren't conveyed to all the other elements that are maneuvering with you that you may be completely unaware of. So sometimes we'll start with a swarming tactic, and then as things start to slow down or stabilize, we'll establish our containment, which may look like we're more set up for a hammer and anvil. And then when the decision to actually go in and take our suspect in the custody is made, we may actually use envelopment. So these tactics aren't real rigid. Like when you're committed to one, you can transition to others, but it takes a little bit of practice. And probably most important is command and control. Like this has to be coordinated. And for SWAT, you know, we're looking for that controlled and disciplined response. And so each of these should be in the toolbox, should understand the strengths and weaknesses and how we can apply them and what resources it's going to take to effectively apply them.
Yeah, and I think you make a really good point. It's so easy, like when we talk about this in a classroom or in books, or reading this, to be like, it's either or, or even like, hey, this is a slow and deliberate, this is a dynamic, this is a breach and hold, this is a breach and delay. Like we think because we started off that way, that that's the way we're doing it the whole time. And really we use all of these tactics, and in one event, depending upon how big it is, you could use all of these in different locations, all in the same location. The point is to know when to use them and talk about it with your people, especially at a patrol level where they're self-deploying to an emergency response with very little command and control. And then as it spins up, or the adversary gets out of the perimeter or any of those things, you can really kind of go, hey, wait a minute, what's the best tactic to create this disparity? And is there any thing, terrain, things like that, that I can use? And I'm not trying to insult anybody's intelligence. I think we do this most of the time pretty well, but you can always do it better. And how often do you explain it or document it in a civil or criminal case even, right? And
So
yeah, you make a great point. I think a lot of our tactics traditionally were often, you know, they were very similar to the hammer and anvil. And with the expectation now, we need to be smarter with what we're trying to do and calculate our risks. And your tactics generally should be more in line with envelopment and pincer to enable the necessary command and control, the coordination, and to avoid that strength on strength confrontation. Like, don't go into the jaws of the lion. We're looking to exploit weakness and, you know, find a situation where we have the highest likelihood of success while using, you know, reasonable force.
So I think we say this a lot when we go through this book together. And I know you and I've said it to each other a lot of times, but I don't want to just read the book to you, but it's hard to say anything better than Sid said it since we're reading Sid's book. So chapter 7 closes out, regardless of which tactical maneuver is chosen, having even a rudimentary understanding of the underlying principles allows a commander to custom tailor them to fit a wide variety of situations. Whether it be putting out a fire, rescuing victims during a storm, or capturing a suspect, both strategy and tactics play essential roles in the ultimate resolution. So again, this goes back to knowing the why, knowing the kind of the art and applying the science, being good at your craft, being a student of your profession. And I think most of the time, every chapter, I think, oh man, this is one of my favorite chapters. And for me, this really kind of helped explain all the things I've been doing a lot of my career. And especially as I moved into other leadership roles, it gave me the confidence to go, hey, I may not know how this turns out, but I can definitely explain to you how I did everything I could to influence the outcome. And, you know, that's all you can do. So any other thoughts, Chris? I know this was a little bit shorter one for us.
Well, I'll just, you know, dovetailing with your last thought, I'll say kind of likewise. You know, I found myself in an environment where everything was hammer and anvil. And it's like, why are we forcing a confrontation at the point where, you know, there's the most reinforcement? And so being able to, you know, take what I had learned in sound doctrine after going to team leader school and tax science and be able to talk about our tactics the team was using in terms of like, you know, envelopment and pincer and give examples of trying to exploit weakness and that it's within our toolbox. Like it's not playing dirty. It's lawful actions, and it may not always be depicted in the movies or on TV, but there are things that we can see in other after action reports and in other real world examples where the envelopment, a pincer, or even swarming are applied successfully and you know, supports the mission that we're trying to accomplish without putting people at unnecessary risk.
And yeah, don't get hung up on you're listening to this and you work in a rural area and there's only one or two of you or maybe three. And you're thinking, well, you need eight people to make this a hammer and anvil. You need eight people to do this or 10 people or 15 people. But really, these principles apply one-on-one, two-on-one, two-on-two. So just do us a favor. If you're listening to this podcast, just for the next week or two, depending upon how busy you are when you're working, after you have one of these kind of calls, sit back and think about it and shoot Chris an email about what happened or send a message. just making sure he's paying attention. Send us a message, man, and go, hey, this is what happened and this is what I saw. And just let us know that, hey, I get it. Right? Because you're doing this already. We're not telling you anything you're not doing. So we hope you like this one. It's a little bit shorter because we're just trying to finish up chapter 7. And we've got a couple other podcasts sprinkled in here, but we will hit chapter 8, which is all about gathering and using intelligence, which in my humble opinion, I know especially for me, I was probably doing it wrong my entire career. And really, especially on SWAT. And until I was in a command function, I mean, we made a plan based on the intel we had, but the formal intel process wasn't nearly quick enough. And until I put myself through a CNT, HNT team leader school, I didn't understand how they both work together better. And so I was, you know, going on what I knew, and there were people doing really good intel that just, I would get that packet when we were already 90% done our planning. And so I really had to ask myself, like, what have I been doing this whole time? And kind of change the procedure. And I didn't wait for the whole packet. We had like a short form. I just say, just give me the short form. If we need to make adjustments, we need to make adjustments. But other than that, I'm just making a plan willy-nilly, and I should be doing it on the best intel. And so we're going to talk a little bit more about formally what that looks like. And maybe that's my bias, but I didn't get a lot. I didn't get a lot of training on that.
Well, the other part that's complementary to that is some people go through the process of filling out a house plan. They're you know, basically just filling the boxes and it's all information, but it's not analyzed or
it's not intel, it's just information.
Yeah, exactly. And I didn't want to give away the premise of the next chapter, but yeah, it's a lot of information. It's words in a packet that don't have a lot of meaning until they're assessed and then applied to the situation that you're trying to solve. And there's definitely an art to that. And there's certainly been some tough lessons learned in the history of law enforcement from that. And I think that it'll be a valuable chapter going forward. And it'll probably be one that'll pull in our tactical dispatchers and our negotiators and maybe even some commanders as they talk about how information and intelligence influences our decision-making and our operational plans.
Well, it's supposed to be all about that, right? Yeah. So it's supposed to be the foundation for all planning. So thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the final little section of chapter 7. If you like what you're doing, send us a note. If you have negative feedback, send it to Chris.
Thank you for listening to the Cato Podcast. To become a member of Cato, check out our website at catotraining.org. If you have a topic suggestion, please send them to podcast@catotraining.org. If you enjoyed the show, please share it with a friend and rate us on the platform of your choice.